All right. The first thing to do if we're going to discuss quantum Shannon theory is to figure out what quantum Shannon theory is, which was Daniel Harlow's question for me yesterday when he saw that this was on the schedule. And over the course of the past week and a half, we've seen that there are these functions, the entropy, the relative entropy, the mutual information, which have these very interesting interpretations in holography. And so we study the functions for their own sake, because in holography they have interpretations. In quantum information theory, we like these functions, but we don't think of the, often we don't think of the functions themselves as primary. We think of various tasks that we'd like to achieve, and then we look at, you know, the optimal way to do it, and then the functions tumble out as the answers to the sort of operationally motivated questions that we ask. And so the idea is that we want to know how to do various things. Like how to compress, how to communicate, say over a noisy channel, how to distill good entanglement from bad. You'll see there are all sorts of tasks that one might be interested in quantum information theory. And so quantum Shannon theory is kind of the theory, you know, the study of how one actually converts different types of quantum mechanical information, whether that's entanglement or classical bits or quantum bits, into each other. And so it's operational. And it usually makes some simplifying assumptions that make it simpler to deal with. And a traditional assumption is to somehow make it kind of asymptotic. And so one version of that is that if we're studying communication, say over a noisy channel, we wouldn't say that we just have one use of the channel. We'd say that we have some k uses of the channel for k large. And then the statistical, we could take advantage of statistical regularities to make some, you know, write down some nice formula. Or if we wanted to distill entanglement, we say that we don't just have a single entangled state to begin with, we have many copies of an entangled state. Now, this assumption, that might strike you as slightly problematic for applications in physics, where we usually have one physical system that we're interested in. And so there, some other notion of asymptotic can play the role, some kind of thermodynamic limit where you have many degrees of freedom, which then leads to the entropy functions that we're familiar with being the right answers to the questions. I should say that there's another, you know, there's a relatively, or a more newly developed school of quantum Shannon theory that really deals with n equals 1 and tries to figure out what the right formulas are even in that case, and that's called one-shot information theory. The other little bit that sort of defines quantum Shannon theory relative to information science as a whole is that we usually make another simplifying assumption, which is that computation is free. And what does that mean? Well, it means that if you want to design some quantum error correcting code to send information or store it in some, you know, and protect it against noise, you don't really care about the fact that when it comes time to decode your code, it might take, you know, an exponential amount of time. You know, even for a relatively small system, the amount of time to decode might be longer than the age of the universe. In practice, that is a problem. But in theory, if you're just sort of interested in whether the information is present or not, that's a reasonable assumption. And in physics, you know, modulo the discussions of complexity we've been having here today, if you're really just interested in the information content, that might actually be not just a simplifying assumption, but the correct assumption. All right. So the starting point for Shannon theory is compression. And so let's start off by trying to interpret entropy. Interpret the entropy of rho. Now, as physicists, I think, write something on the board here. Because I want to talk about qubits today, let's define that my logarithm would be log base 2. Physicists are used to, you know, that you think about entropy all the time. And all physicists have some kind of intuitive understanding of what it is, that the entropy controls the effective size of the Hilbert space, right? The number of relevant degrees of freedom. And that's the, you know, that's sort of the intuition that comes from statistical mechanics. So S of rho controls the effective Hilbert space dimension, which is something like 2 to the n times the, or, well, all right, 2 to the entropy, say. Now, that may or may not actually be precisely true. But there are circumstances in which it is true. And for example, if we have a quantum state rho, and we take many copies of it, so this is, I'm going to use through most of the talk this kind of version of the asymptotics, just because in that case, I can make precise statements that I know to be true. But you shouldn't be disturbed by the fact that I'm taking many copies of a system. As I said, in cases of physical interest, field theories, typically that's not going to be necessary if you look at a lot, many degrees of freedom, and I'll have more to say about that. But suppose that we have many copies of this density operator rho. The precise statement that one can make is that there exists a projector, let's call it pi n epsilon, acting on the Hilbert space, such that the trace of the density operator against that projector is big, right? So that projector captures most of the non-negative part of the eigenspace of rho, or rho tensor n. And in addition, the rank of pi n epsilon is less than or equal to 2 to the n s of rho plus something subleading, little o of n, you know, order square root of n. And so this is the, you know, this is actually a precise statement of there being a roughly 2 to the n times the entropy dimensional subspace in which rho actually lives, right? Now, we can actually say a little bit more than that. So we can make a stronger statement. We can say that if we take, say, phi rho is a purification of rho, and say that's on R and A, then if we take n copies of that purification, and then we do nothing on R, I use R for reference system, and then we act with a projector on A, then we again have some quantity which is larger than 1 minus epsilon. And if you remember from the first QI basics talk, this expression, the somehow the overlap, or the the expectation value of pi, this is, I guess, the expectation, oh, actually, this follows immediately, does it? This follows immediately from this statement, actually. So I shouldn't say it's stronger, but it looks stronger. This is saying that the fidelity, it's saying this statement, but it's saying that if we act with this projector, that projector does not damage the entanglement between the reference system and A. Right? So this projector doesn't just, you know, it's not just that if you were to measure it, you get the state back with high probability. It really, you know, if you act with it, it just doesn't, it barely changes the state at all. And so in this sense, we can think there's not just an effective Hilbert space dimension, but there's a notion of compression associated with the subspace, that we could act by a quantum channel that would shrink the dimension of the Hilbert space while preserving all of the entanglement with a reference system. Yes, yes. So the question was, is there also a statement that this is the best you can do? And I should write that in there. This is optimal. And you're not going to, on your problem set for today, I didn't ask you to prove precisely this statement, but you can using exactly the same tools. I'm going to ask you to prove the optimality of something we're going to do in a little bit. And actually, now that I think about it, the thing you're going to prove is stronger than this, and so it implies there's a special case. It's optimal for any row. So it's generally true that if you want to satisfy this condition that you're going to preserve entanglement with a reference system, that you cannot actually shrink the Hilbert space dimension beyond so that the number of qubits is smaller than log or smaller than the entropy. All right. So one last way of thinking about this, which is quite useful, is that we could say that there exists a unitary transformation U that will take rho, tensor n, take n copies of rho, and will actually implement the compression for us. So what will that compression do? Well, it's going to send out two Hilbert spaces, so maybe I'll call them T and T bar. And T, so there's some set of qubits that come out. So the input system is AN, and we have AN, we can think of as T tensor T bar. And the log of the dimension of T is about 2 to the n times the entropy. So I'm going to drop these little o of n terms from now on, just, you know, and put in little squiggles instead. So this is the system that we're compressing to. And then there's also some junk that comes out. And that junk is approximately always, you know, some fixed state. So we could say maybe it's a bunch of qubits in the zero state. And so you could also think of compression as taking all the uncertainty in the density operator, concentrating it on some subsystem, and then leaving the other subsystem in a pure state independent of the input, right? So in this sense, compression actually looks like a kind of refrigeration, right? You're pumping all of the, you know, all of the noise, all of the heat into T, and what's left in T bar is actually the, a fixed pure quantum state. And so we're going to use this picture of compression in a little bit. So how do you construct? This projector. Yeah. In what operational setting? Well, if you have some source, if you have some source of noise, right? That is just doing the same thing over and over again, or some source of information, right? Like, again, this is kind of a pretty simplified setting in which you sort of imagine there are no correlations, right? But if you have a source of information, right? Like maybe you're just monitoring, some physical degree of freedom that's varying as a function of time. If you chunk this into big enough, you know, chunks, then the amount of correlation between them is going to be pretty small, you know, in many settings, right? If it decays exponentially with time or something, right? So then this might be a reasonable approximation. Yeah, sure. I mean, it really just means that there's some process that is repeating itself, and there are. And each realization is independent. That's all it is, right? And so you can generalize this, right? That maybe you have some process which is stationary in some sense, and then a similar kind of statement still holds. This is just the simplest, you know, setting in which you can speak this way. Another setting in which this comes up, right? Sort of almost in some sense as a bit of an artifact. Let's say you wanted to communicate. Over some noisy channel, right? You might think that having the channel being some, you know, every time you use the channel is independent of the previous time. You might think, okay, well, that actually sounds like a reasonable assumption. It turns out this machinery is exactly what you need to analyze that setting, even if the messages you're transmitting are not independent, right? So you can send some arbitrarily correlated message, but the statistical regularity in the channel means that these kinds of assumptions turn out to be the right tools for analyzing the situation. But I agree. I mean, in general, this is just an easy case, right, to sort of help orient yourself. And for that reason, actually, I wasn't planning to tell you exactly how to construct this projector. So I'm just going to say, you use the law of large numbers. in the eigenbasis. Of rho tensor n. All right, so just as if, just like when you're, if you have a biased coin and you flip the coin some number of times, if heads occurs with probability p, you expect to see n times p heads, right? And so out of all possible strings of heads and tails, only a small number of them are likely to occur if n is large, and that you just do the same thing in the eigenbasis. And so you can look that up, but I think most of you can, you may have seen this before in some form, so I'm going to try to do something more interesting with today's lecture. But something more interesting than that is that you can use the symmetry. All right, so there's some permutation symmetry in this state. And you can use the permutation symmetry to construct the projector. And you can construct one projector that works for all possible rho. And so that's the starting point for kind of thinking about the role of symmetry in quantum information, and I recommend that you go to the Focus lecture this afternoon by Michael Walter, in which he'll show you how to construct this projector using the representation theory of SN, he'll even give you a hint of how you can prove strong subadditivity as a consequence of the structure of the representations of SN and their tensor products. So that's a nice topic, but we're going to move on from there. And I just, again, wanted to write on the board that in physics, we often care about, you know, if n equals 1, right? So we don't have any law of large numbers. But as I was saying before, if you take some reasonably large chunk of some many-body system, there are many interacting pieces, and you can often get the same kind of statistical regularity that will ensure that there is a projector and an effective Hilbert space of size 2 to the entropy in that case, because n is equal to 1. And so, for example, if you want to do this in a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, which you might think is a particularly hard case because you have correlations at all length scales, and so you can't think of this as being sort of independent chunks, this is something like this is still true, and you can check out a paper that I wrote with Bartek Cech, Brian Swingle, and Nima Lashkari in 2014. To see how you would construct such a projector. And that'll be relevant to the end of the talk. I guess I should say that we're going to end this talk by thinking about some applications of these ideas to holography that appeared in this paper. All right, so that's all I want to tell you about the entropy, that it controls effective Hilbert space dimension, and you should remember the existence of this pi. You should remember the existence of this compression procedure that looks like a refrigerator. Yes, question?
Just a clarification on this.
Oh, yeah, thank you. How about this? 1 over n goes to s over o. That's better. all right. So far, so familiar. I'm probably not telling you anything that you didn't intuit, although I should tell you that you might have to work in any given case to really justify that 2 to the entropy really is the effective Hilbert space dimension. So let's try something that you may not know. So we've interpreted the entropy. Let's interpret the mutual information. Question mark. So maybe I'll ask the audience. Now, if you know the answer, you can't answer. You're prohibited from responding. But what do you think operationally? What is the mutual information? What should it be? Any ideas? It's a measure of correlation. What kinds of operations might you think would measure? Kind of be related to correlations, or what might be a sort of ideal form of correlation, or what? Any ideas? Like a Schmidt rank? Oh, that's actually an interesting idea. So in the case of a pure state, it's kind of a smoothed out notion of shrink rank, of Schmidt rank, that's true. And so in the case of pure states, it's related to the number of Bell pairs that you can extract from many copies of the state. And so you might think that's true in general, right? that the mutual information measures how much useful correlation you can extract from the state. As far as I know, that's false. Yeah, that's actually just not the right answer to what mutual information is. It's not telling you how much useful correlation there is in the state. It's telling you something else. And it's actually in some ways telling you, well, if it's not opposite, it's kind of dual. So it's telling you the number of qubits one must discard from AN in order to destroy all correlations. In row AB tensor N. So this doesn't sound like a very constructive answer to the question, but it is an answer, right? That if the mutual information is strictly positive, that tells you that the state is not product, right? Now, if you threw away all of the qubits of AN, then you trivially have a product state. You have no correlations left, right? There is no AN left. But maybe you could get by with throwing away not all of the qubits, but just a subset of them, and still end up with a product state. And that's typically true, and the number of qubits you have to throw away is rho AB tensor N, or is the mutual information, or just to get our constants right, it's actually 1/2 the mutual information. So we're going to interpret 1/2 the mutual information. Now again, this may not seem terribly constructive, but I want to encourage you to follow at this point, because it turns out that this seemingly useless procedure is the starting point for understanding an awful lot of constructive stuff. But we're going to start off with the seemingly useful procedure, useless procedure. So let's just check this in some examples in which we can just do it by hand. So, yeah?
Is there like a way to see why this isn't the same as the useful information between the two, or is it just completely different?
Why isn't
this the same as the first definition you gave as the useful?
Like the effective, the one, like how much useful correlation there is?
Yeah.
I would have to give you examples. So there are examples. So the question was, can we just see that, so here I'm telling you this is one interpretation of mutual information. I said there's another interpretation, which is how much useful correlation you could get out. I claim this useful correlation question characterization is wrong. And he asked, can you see that easily? I don't know that you can see it super easily, but I can give you examples of states in which this quantum mutual information is very high, but any measurement procedure that you apply to the A side and the B side is always going to result in a classical probability distribution with a negligible amount of mutual information. So there can be lots of quantum mutual information in there that's just inaccessible to any measurements. So such examples exist. All right, so the first example that I want to think about is just a pure quantum state. We'll take n copies of it, all right? And we're just going to verify that the number of qubits you have to throw away is 1/2 the mutual information. So let's just calculate, what do we know? The entropy of A for phi, this is a pure state, so it's the same as the entropy of B for phi, right? Because if you remember the Schmidt decomposition, the non-zero eigenvalues of the two reduced density operators are the same, so their entropies are the same. And it's a pure state, so the joint entropy is zero. Right? So in this case, 1/2 the mutual information is just the entropy. So can someone give me a procedure that will destroy the correlations between A and B in which we only discard one-half mutual information qubits. Okay, I see some people pointing. Right, so we just take this unitary that performs the compression. We discard the compressed piece, whose size is controlled by the entropy, and what's left is just a pure state which factorizes with the other half, right? So what we do is we compress An to T tensor T bar, and the size of this is controlled by the entropy. And then we discard T. Done. All right, so, yeah. So let's say is approximately n over 2 times the mutual information. Yeah. So the question was, I wrote down an absolute number of qubits, but they're n copies of rho, so the answer actually has to scale with rho. So just throw an n in front there. All right, so this is an easy case, but at least it works so far. Let's do a slightly trickier case. Oh, and again, just to give you the preview, if you go to the problem session this afternoon, you're going to prove the optimality of this statement. And as I asserted before, because Schumacher compression is contained as a special case of destroying correlations, you'll be implicitly proving the optimality of Schumacher compression at the same time. I didn't mention Schumacher's name. Schumacher's the guy who first thought about quantum compression. All right, example two. So let's think about a density operator whose form is, say, 1 over dimension, sum over, say, x equals 1 to dimension, projector onto x, tensor projector onto x. So this is kind of heavy notation, but what this is two perfectly correlated classical systems, right? You have a d-sided equally weighted die, you flip it, and you give the answer to both Alice and Bob, and they end up with a correlated probability distribution. So let's work out our entropies again. Well, the entropy of A is just the entropy of a uniform distribution on d elements. It's log d. That's the same as the entropy for B. But it's actually the same as the entropy for AB, because collectively all of the uncertainty there is just that you have D things uniformly distributed and orthogonal. So all of those entropies are the same. But now one half mutual information is therefore one half the log of the dimension, right? Because it's this plus this minus this, which is log D divided by 2. So now, the strategy of just compressing A is not going to work. Because if you compress A, you're going to get about log d qubits, or n times log d. But you're supposed to be able to destroy all these correlations by discarding half as many qubits as that. Right? So we have to find a way to destroy the correlation more efficiently than just compressing the A system and then discarding the qubits. So our strategy of example one fails. So what should we do? Well, we have to use quantum mechanics. Let's change basis. And again, just to keep things super simple, to see, illustrate what's going on, let's say the dimension is 4, so A consists of 2 qubits. OK. And then what you do is you map x to a quantum state phi sub x, where this is the Bell state labeled by x. Right? So a Pauli operator sigma x tensored with the identity acting on the fixed phi 0. Phi 0 is 0, 0 plus 1, 1. Right? So I have x goes from 1 to 4. So I have four orthogonal states in the Hilbert space. I can just change basis, mapping x to four different orthogonal states, which are four maximally entangled states. Okay? Now, these states have the property that if I take the trace, say, over A1 of phi sub x, what state do I get? Daniel? That was actually a visual answer. It's this state. It's the state which is maximally mixed, right? So if you take a maximally entangled state and you trace over half of it, you just get a maximally mixed state. That maximally mixed state has completely forgotten the label x, right? So there's no information left about x. And so this gives us a way to destroy the correlations. So we change basis, and then we have Alice discards, say, A1. And of course, the size of A1 is 1 qubit. And 1 half log d is 1 half times the logarithm of 4 is 1. Right? So this worked. So by changing basis, we could then get away with only discarding half the system and still destroying all of the correlations. And so we've succeeded in destroying the correlations, throwing away a number of qubits, which is 1 half the mutual information. Is that clear? Good. So to handle the general case, we actually just have to combine these two ideas. That's all there is to it. So the general case So one, Alice compresses AN to, I guess, T tensor T bar, as before, where T, the size of T is controlled by the entropy. Two, she applies a random unitary. To T. Okay, so here are our two first steps for the procedure. The first step looks exactly like how we handled example one, right? Alice compressed her system down to a subsystem whose size was n times the entropy. So that's the first step. The second step, Alice applies a random unitary to the compressed system, right? So what does a random unitary do? It generically takes, you know, you'll see in Daniel's lecture tomorrow or Thursday, random unitaries generically produce states that are highly, highly entangled. That should be somewhat intuitive in that being a product state is a very special condition. The generic condition in Hilbert space is that most states are highly entangled. So if you apply a random unitary to T, then you somehow make highly entangled states, which are very efficient for destroying correlations. And then Alice just needs to discard approximately n times the mutual information qubits from T. And this works. I'm not going to prove to you that it works. The follow-up reading for the course, I indicated that John Preskill's lecture notes, which are available on his website and on the archive on quantum Shannon theory, he sketches out this proof and gives you the references to the original papers where we do such things. But hopefully it's pretty intuitive, right? It's just saying that you don't get any surprises. Once you've understood examples one and example two, if you do the calculation, it's always going to work. Okay. So that was, and you're going to prove this is optimal. Oh, whoa. Divided by two. So again, this is a characterization, but it doesn't seem like a particularly useful characterization. It doesn't tell you how to do other things that you might want to do. So now let's actually see what you could use this fact for. We need to recall, this is a little aside, recall a fact from the QI basics problem set. So I know that everybody did all the problems, and so you will all be familiar with this fact. The reason I stuck in that bit commitment example is one, because it's sort of historically interesting, but two, it got you to prove this little fact that I needed today. So if we have two states, let's call them psi, on xy, so x tensor-y is our Hilbert space, and say c, say satisfy that the reduced density operators on the x system are the same, right? So psi and xi have the same reduced density operator on the x subsystem. Then there exists a unitary on y such that C of xy is the identity on x, unitary on y, acting on psi of xy. All right, so if you recall, you proved this thing, and you proved this using the Schmidt decomposition. What it's saying is that all purifications of a fixed density operator are related by a unitary transformation on the purifying space. Right? That's the other way of stating this. So it has an immediate implication, which is that if we want to calculate the fidelity between two density operators, if you remember from, again, the QI basics course, the fidelity was defined as the maximum over all purifications of rho and sigma of the overlap between rho and sigma. So let's just say that rho and sigma are density operators on X. By this fact, we can write this as the maximum over all unitaries Y of the overlap between some fixed purification of rho, the unitary acting on Y, and some fixed purification of sigma. Right? Because you've seen, you proved for yourselves that all purifications of a fixed density operator can be constructed by acting unitarily on the purifying space. The fidelity is the maximum over all purifications, but we can construct all purifications by just acting unitarily in the purifying space. So the optimization over purifications is just the same as the optimization over changes of basis, or one-sided changes of basis in the purifying space. So that we're going to use this formula. And I just wanted to insert it now so we didn't have to stop and prove it as a distraction as we were moving along. So I guess I'll try to, I don't want to erase this panel. If I start to erase it, yell at me and stop me from doing so. Yeah. It is not true classically. That's correct. Classically, you can, there's an analogous result, which is that the number of bits you have to throw away is the mutual information. Oh, and I forgot to repeat the question, but the question was, since we used quantum mechanics in the proof, is it not true classically? And of course, it couldn't be true classically. Or, well, I don't know. I don't know what it means to throw away a qubit from a classical system, but I guess that you could just be throwing away bits. But the answer is the one I said. There's an analogous result without the factor of a half. Okay. So now what we're going to do is we're going to use this destroying correlations construction to do something productive and useful. We're going to generalize compression. aha, is this what I'm kicking? There we go. So I'll just say, here's our compression picture. I'm going to draw a little cartoon of what compression does. So I'm going to depict an entangled state with two little dots. There's a subsystem, say, n times the reference. There's a subsystem n times A. And the quantum state is n copies of some quantum state phi. And I can't help myself. I'm going to personify this. I guess a little aside, I think a lot of people who don't do quantum information, when they start reading quantum information papers, they start pulling their hair out because there's all this Allison Bobbing around. And when you do quantum information, you realize that Allison Bob are serving just often as shorthand notation, that we describe communication between Allison Bob, but that's just sort of a way of sort of formalizing some relationships. Like, compression is a perfectly sensible question to ask in the absence of Allison Bob, but it can be helpful to think in terms of Allison Bob when you're analyzing it. And so a lot of my Allison Bobbing, even though you may not have Allison Bob in your problems, is nonetheless relevant to physical questions. So they have an entangled state, and we can think of compression as asking what is the minimum number of qubits that Alice needs to send to Bob in order to transfer her part of the quantum state to Bob. So if Alice sends qubits at the rate given by the entropy, then I'll just put a greater than or equal to sign. It means that with this quantum state and this resource of communication, they can prepare the quantum state Rn, and maybe I'll call it A tilde n, like so. Where this is now, I'll call it phi tilde n, with the condition that the fidelity between the original state and the final state is big. All right, so this is just a slightly seemingly elaborate or maybe complicated way of phrasing the compression fact, right? That because Alice can compress her system to a number of qubits, which is given by roughly n times the entropy, once it's compressed, she could just take those qubits and transfer them to Bob, and then Bob could perform the inverse operation, right? Mapping the compressed system into a copy, or into n copies of the A Hilbert space, and they'd have two states. Bob would have established a state which is very, very close to the original. It's just not exactly the original, because the compression did throw away a small amount of, did slightly distort the state in the process. Does this make sense? Just as a picture, cartoon? All right. So what we're going to do, we're going to do something stronger and more interesting than Schumacher compression. So it's going to look pretty similar. So there's going to be the reference, n times, n copies of the A system, n copies of the B system. Bob holds the B's. Alice holds the A's, like that. And so the initial state is just some general tripartite entangled state, right? I've written it with three squiggly lines that you shouldn't think of that as meaning there's bipartite entangled between A and R, R and B, and B and A. It's a totally arbitrary quantum state phi, and we take n copies of it. And then we're going to say Alice sends qubits to Bob at some rate. And what's supposed to happen is exactly the same thing as Schumacher compression. So Bob's over here. There's the Rn system, phi tilde n, bn. Now there's a copy of the A system, like that. Then there's our poor Alice who's given everything up. So this is a communication problem, right? So just like in the case of Schumacher compression, Alice is trying to transfer her part of the state to Bob. The difference is that Bob starts off actually holding something non-trivial, right? That Bob's system is now correlated in some interesting way with Alice's and the references. And so potentially that's something that, you know, that they can exploit to reduce the amount of communication smaller than the entropy, right? That if this is the goal, they can always succeed at doing it by just having Alice compress the A system and then send n times entropy qubits to Bob, right? That's always going to work. But because Bob has some additional correlation there, maybe the communication can be made less, right? And this is, you know, typically what happens, you know, if you think about how information behaves, right? If you are Bob, and maybe you are well informed on the ADS-CFT correspondence already, then it's not necessary for you to attend all of the lectures and receive the entire stream of information, right? That maybe, you know, McCun just says, oh, I did mention this one interesting fact that you don't know. You might like to hear it. And that's the more efficient way of getting that information across. And the same thing should be true in quantum mechanics, right? And the question is, you know, how much can we save? So let's figure it out. All right, so here's the procedure. So first, Alice compresses to T tensor T bar. And then as before, well actually I'm gonna say T, now I'm gonna write it as K tensor D. So K for keep and D for discard. Right? So if you remember, well, it's gone now, but we were talking about destroying correlations. The procedure for destroying correlations was that Alice first compressed, and then she separated her qubits into some fraction that she kept and some fraction that she discarded. Right? So I've just explicitly written out the factor that she discards. And we know that 1 over n times the log of the dimension of d goes to 1 half the mutual information. Oops. Right, that's the thing that we've proved. So there are questions about, so here I'm just using the, you know, Alice is destroying correlations. So i.e., Alice destroys the R n tensor A n correlations. So far, Alice is just doing exactly the thing that we showed was possible. And what I want to tell you, you know, the next step is that instead of taking those qubits that she was going to discard to destroy all the correlation and throwing them in the garbage bin, she sends them to Bob. So Alice sends D to Bob. And so now we know what the rate is, 1 half the mutual information between A and R, the quantum state phi. Although we don't have any sense of why this works, right? I claim that this is actually, we're almost done, although it probably isn't obvious to you. So now, what's going to happen next is somehow the trickiest part of this whole business. And so if you don't get it, stop me. The argument that we're going to use is an argument that appears not just in, This problem is actually very general, has many applications, but it appears in, say, the black holes as mirrors paper that I wrote with John Preskill, and it appears over and over again in quantum information. So it's really useful to understand the argument. So let me just see what I want to make sure that I give you the argument in the way that I thought was best. Right, so the best way to give you the argument is to draw a picture. So let's describe the initial quantum state as having three pieces, An, or Rn, Bn, An. So here I had my cartoon. I'm going to take that cartoon and draw it as a quantum circuit, right? So here's three subsystems of the quantum state phi tensor n, and time is going to go from left to right. So the first thing Alice does is she performs some unitary vise, and out of that comes the discard system, the keep system, and the t-bar system. And t-bar is really just a bunch of zeros. If you remember the compression, when you did compression, there was a piece that was refrigerated. So I'm just going to ignore this from now on. Doesn't matter, right? Just a pure state that doesn't play any role, so I'm going to throw it away. And then I'm just going to extend these lines. So here's the compression, the refrigerated part, the compressed part. The compressed part is divided into two pieces, a discard and a keep. The discard is transferred to Bob. Let me see. I'll draw Bob in here too. So, here we have Alice, here we have Bob, and then we have the reference. So does that picture make sense just as a kind of a formalization of the procedure that I've described in words down here? Just encoding all of that. Okay, so now we just, I'm going to include some labels. Let's say that we have the actual quantum state at that point is sigma. And to an excellent approximation, even if I ignore t-bar, it's a pure state, right? Because the refrigerated part was some pure state that factorized with the rest, and so when I threw it away, the state remained pure. So let's call that a pure state sigma, okay? So now, we destroyed correlations. This is, so far that's all we know, right? We've destroyed some correlations. So how do I express that mathematically? I can say that the fidelity of the actual state of sigma, if I look at Rn and K, right? So I said we destroyed the correlations between the reference and A, right? What does that mean? It means the part that is kept in A, the keep part, should factorize with the reference. So this fidelity looks like the reduced density operator on the reference system. We never touched the reference system, so it's still just what it was at the beginning. Tensor product some other state. And I'm just going to assert to you that we can actually make it the maximally mixed state. So absolute value k, I just mean the dimension. So by virtue of the fact that we've destroyed correlations, when I say we destroyed correlations, if I was going to formalize that statement mathematically, how would I formalize it? I'd say if we look at the density operator of what's left, that density operator should be a product density operator, right? So I didn't formally define what it meant to destroy correlations, but let's say this is what it means, right? That if you destroy correlations, what's left behind is a product density operator. Maybe we wouldn't require that it be maximally mixed, but it turns out you get that for free. So let's just say it's maximally mixed on the K system. So are there questions about sort of what we've managed to do so far? Yeah, Daniel. So the question is, why is it maximally mixed? And the answer is somehow that we first applied this random unitary. And then we started throwing stuff away. Because we compressed beforehand, once we destroy the correlations, the state has entropy, which is close to its maximum possible value if you check. And so if the entropy is close to its maximum possible value, by throwing away a few more qubits, you can make it maximally mixed. So you can get this, yeah, pretty much for free. Yeah, Ning. To phrase monogamy of entanglement in terms of this destroying correlations statement?
Sorry, to phrase MMI in terms of, like, in terms of some incompressibility problem.
Oh, yeah, sure. So the question was, in the holographic setting, is there a way to express the monogamy of mutual information in this operational way? And the answer is yes. I mean, a good portion of the audience doesn't know probably what monogamy mutual information is, so I don't want to get too far off track. But it's roughly speaking that the mutual information of the whole is larger than the sum of the mutual information of the parts. And so what turns out to be true is you could try to destroy the correlation in the parts, right? And you'll succeed at destroying the correlation in each of the parts. But because of this monogamy property, or the superadditivity property, there will still be correlations left in the whole. So there's a direct operational sort of manifestation of monogamy in that way. Okay, so we've established that by destroying correlations, these are what the density operators look like. I'm going to write down a purification of the state on the right. So here's a purification. So I'm going to purify the reference system, phi. So this thing here is basically n copies of phi. And so there's Rn, A tilde n, Bn. So this state, right, if I trace over A tilde n, Bn, is a purification of phi on the reference. And then down here, I have a maximally mixed state on K. How can I purify a maximally mixed state? It needs to be a pure state. So not maximally mixed, but maximally entangled. Right. So I could use a maximally entangled state. So let's call the purifying system L. And I'll call this capital phi KL, which is now maximally entangled. So here, I have a purification. And, And then, so that's a purification of the state on the right. And then sigma itself is a purification of sigma on RnK, right? So I have two states. In my fidelity, I have a purification of sigma on the left, and I have a purification of phi tensor maximally mixed on the right. And now, this is going to, you know, like, this is pulling a rabbit out of a hat, right? Here's the magician's trick, right? So we use the thing that you proved for yourselves, right? That if I have two density operators that are close in fidelity, then there exists a unitary on the purifying system that relates them, right? So who holds the purification of K and R? Bob does. So there's the U. And the U, it's getting a bit busy on the board, but the U comes from star. So this may be, you know, again, I said this is the trickiest part of the whole business. And so it's worth going through it again, I think. So Alice basically destroyed her correlations with the reference, right? So she produced a state in her laboratory which was close to having a tensor product form. The actual physical purification of that state is held by Bob. And we can, but we can also think of sort of idealized purification, where we can think of any other purification we want. And because all purifications are related by unitaries on the purifying system, there exists some unitary transformation for Bob that will take his degrees of freedom and reorganize them so that the output state has the form phi tensor n, tensor with a maximally entangled state. Okay? So, so if you look at this picture, right? In this picture, because Alice has transferred her system to Bob, at the end of the day, Alice should have a state that factorizes with the reference, right? And whatever is held here, all of the entanglement of the reference is in Bob's lab, so Alice's state should factorize with the reference. That's a necessary condition for them to have succeeded. But what we're finding is that necessary condition is also sufficient, right? That as long as Alice's state factorizes with the reference, because Bob holds the purification, he can fix things up and make sure that he has the desired state. So I like to think of this, you know, like maybe you have an old car and you're driving around, and all of a sudden the cabin of the car is filled with acrid smoke and you're coughing and wheezing and you're like, oh dear, this is bad. I have to go to the garage to get this fixed. And you wheel into the garage, and your mechanic says, well, what seems to be the problem? He said, well, there's this acrid smoke everywhere. And the mechanic just says, okay, let me see if I can fix that. And he rolls down the windows on the car, and the smoke, you know, clears out. And he says, all right, fixed. Right? And you say, well, wait a second. That was just a symptom of the actual problem. You have to fix the problem, not just the symptom. And he says, no. You know, smoke is all there is. Somehow here, you know, and of course, you would not pay such a mechanic. But here, as long as you get rid of the smoke, which is the correlation between the reference and Alice, somehow you've solved the problem, right? Bob can fix things up, right? You don't need a mechanic beyond, you know, all you need to do is open your windows and let the correlation, you know, drift away. So this, you know, it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around, but this is extremely powerful in quantum information, that you look at the purified system, you figure out who needs to factorize with whom in order to, for the final state to have the right form. And if you succeed in producing the right factorizations, typically you've succeeded in solving your problem. Yeah? Oh, good question. Yeah, so the question was, how does Bob determine which U? So at least formally, Bob knows the quantum state they started with. And U, in U, I mean U, not just the general U, but U found the U, right? Because the U comes from the singular value decomposition that was used to prove the Schmidt decomposition. So at least, you know, formally, you know, you can, you know, sit down and work out how you prove the Schmidt, how you prove the singular value decomposition. That information encodes the structure of U. If you were to do that, what you would find is that this unitary that Bob needs to perform would actually take him amount of time which is exponential in the number of qubits. This procedure is not at all practical. But it, you know, it's a demonstration that exists, and we also now know, you know, polynomial and even close to linear time algorithms for making this work, but that's not our concern here today. All right. Yeah. About how to do, well, because you applied a random unitary to T, the choice of factorization really doesn't matter. Right? When I said random unitary, I meant Haar measure, right? So then all choices of subsystem, you know, the only information that's left about a choice of subsystem is its size. So at least at the level that we're talking now, it doesn't matter. Yeah. This is another message about Shannon theory, that often you prove the existence of things by averaging, you know, over, and this is Shannon theory, classical and quantum. You don't know how to do something, and then so you say, okay, well, let's just fix some general parameters of the problem, and then the things we don't know how to actually, you know, we don't have any better ideas for how to, you know, how to go any further, we just choose them totally at random from the largest possible set, which is consistent with our restrictions. And it turns out that stupid-sounding strategy is a great strategy that discovers all kinds of things you could never discover on your own. So this is just the general probabilistic method, I guess, in mathematics. But when you actually apply it, it's quite invigorating, and an analytical amplifier. Okay, so This is what we tried to achieve, right? Just transferring Alice's system to Bob. But lo and behold, there's a side effect, right? Not only does Bob get the purification of the reference, but he gets half of a maximally entangled state, which is shared with Alice. So this is e-bits. So an e-bit is just a Bell pair. You have a maximally entangled state of two qubits. And then we could ask, well, how big is this maximally entangled state, right? So how many e-bits? Well, let's just stress. This is bonus, right? We didn't even try to make e-bits, and we got them for free. That's great. So how many e-bits? So 1 over n, the log of the dimension of t, is about the entropy, right? Because t was the compressed, was Alice's compressed system. And then we took t and we threw away the discard, right? So 1 over n times the log of the dimension of k, what is kept, is going to be the entropy, right? It's what you started with minus what you threw away. So what you threw away was 1/2 the mutual information between R and the reference, right? That this mutual information is the number of qubits that we transferred from Alice to Bob. The number of qubits that we transferred from Alice to Bob was 1/2 the mutual information. So we started off with entropy qubits. We subtracted off 1/2 mutual information qubits. And here's a little calculation, which you should do for yourselves. This is actually 1/2 the mutual information between Alice and Bob. Since we have a pure state on RAB. So this is the usual kind of thing. You write out all these entropies. Some of them cancel. And then sometimes you take a system and you replace it by its complement. Like it might be an R and you replace it by AB because their entropies are the same. And you'll see this is just an identity. And so the amount of entanglement they end up with is 1/2 the mutual information between Alice and Bob. And that's kind of satisfying, right? That they started off with some correlation measured by mutual information. And at the end of the protocol, they converted that mutual information into Bell pairs, into entanglement, right? And so at the beginning, I said, well, you can't really interpret mutual information in a simple way as the amount of useful correlation in a state. But in this more complicated way, you can. That in the context of this protocol where Alice is trying to transfer her system to Bob, the amount of entanglement, the amount of useful correlation they produce between themselves is controlled by their mutual information, right? So it's a much more elaborate statement, but it's there. And again, just to drive it home, the number of qubits that Alice needs to send to Bob, that's also an intuitive quantity, right? That the amount of qubits Alice needs to send to Bob is controlled by how much mutual information she has with the reference, right? Bob doesn't have Alice's correlation with the reference yet, so Alice needs to send him some amount of information, which depends on how correlated she is with the reference. And so that's these numbers, once you sort of get used to it, are pretty intuitive. Are there questions? Yeah?
So if you wanted to maximize the number of e-bits to send to Bob, that would have been already optimal?
If you wanted to maximize the number of e-bits, so what you're doing here is a little bit different. Like you are maximizing the number of e-bits subject to the constraint that you transfer Alice's state to Bob. If you just pure wanted to maximize the number of e-bits, I don't think this would be the right answer. However, hold that thought for 5 minutes. Because we are going to talk about establishing e-bits. The mutual information between Alice and Bob. No, that's not necessarily the case. They could have, you know, this initial state they could have shared could have included just some e-bits between them as well. Anything's allowed.
Let's suppose they only share classical information.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So this, after the end of this, they are sharing qubits. How did that happen?
So if Alice and Bob only have classical correlations in the sense that when they trace over the reference, you just have, say, like correlated bits, then what ends up happening is that Alice's classical bit somehow gets absorbed into Bob's when you transfer it. Like, you know, if you have two copies of a classical message in your laboratory, you might as well just have one of them. And those become bell pairs between the reference and Bob, that in the case of classical bits.
So if you're
trying to establish bell pairs, that's a perfectly permissible protocol. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I don't think this will be optimal, but I actually hesitate to say, I don't think it is optimal. Okay. So we've done this, and now let's consider another task. How much time do I have here? Not too much time. Well, let's do it. How to go from many copies of a mixed state row, or actually just call it phi, to, let's say, minus the entropy of A given B, phi e-bits. Right, so here you have some mixed state between Alice and Bob. It could be anything. And they want to take that mixed state, which might have some entanglement in it. And if it's entangled, the conditional entropy might be negative. And they want to convert it by LOCC into bell pairs. And I just want to use this to illustrate how powerful these things are. Now, maybe I'll put one of our illustrious hosts on the spot, and I'll ask Rob. So Rob, do you know how to construct a protocol that will distill good entanglement from bad in the general case like this?
No,
okay. Wrong. Your answer, you gave the wrong answer to that question. So it turns out you know how to do this, and you just don't know that you know how to do this. Let's remember teleportation. I'm going to write it in a sort of mnemonic form, okay? So if you have a bell pair, so that's my QQ, plus two classical bits of communication from Alice to Bob, that is bigger, or you know, more powerful, than a qubit of communication, one qubit, Alice to Bob. All right, so there's my mnemonic for teleportation. If you have a bell pair and you have two classical bits of communication, you can use that to implement a channel that transports one qubit from Alice to Bob. That's what teleportation does for you. Okay? So is that notation? I just want notation so I can substitute in an equation. So now let's look at what we've achieved over here, and I'll write it again just mnemonically, starting from many copies of phi and making use of 1/2 mutual information, A in reference, phi qubits of communication. We get 1/2 mutual information Alice Bob phi bell pairs. Right, so this is just an inequality which is intended to encode what we've managed to achieve here. If we start off with the quantum state phi, which is shared between Alice and Bob, I'm just going to ignore the reference completely, and we invest some communication, what we get out is bell pairs, and that's the rate. So let's just substitute in. That is, implement the quantum communication using teleportation. Right? So then we end up with, we start off with our quantum states. One half mutual information, that's an R, an e-bit plus two classical bits is greater than or equal to 1/2 mutual information Alice Bob e-bits, like so, right? So now my inequality contains only classical communication and bell pairs. So let's just take the bell pairs and put them all on the right-hand side and look at our net production of bell pairs, right? So we can say phi, our mixed state that we started with, plus some classical communication, right? So this is LOCC. In fact, only one direction from Alice to Bob is greater than or equal to some number of bell pairs, right? And the number of bell pairs is the mutual information between Alice and Bob minus the mutual information between Alice and the reference, right? So I'm just taking this piece and moving it to the other side of the inequality, right? So that I look at our net production of bell pairs. And again, this is just an identity which you should check for yourselves. That difference of 1/2 mutual informations is just minus the conditional entropy. So, you know, you should check for any pure phi A B R. And so Rob is verifying. I told him that he knows how to do it, so he's just checking to make sure that he does know how to do it. It's a difference of mutual informations. You take it away. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, when you plug it in, you get minus the conditional entropy. And so you just, you know, you without realizing it, just figure out how to do something that presumably at the beginning of the lecture, I suspect for, you know, 90% of you, you did not know how to do. Given arbitrary mixed state entanglement, how to convert it at some non-trivial rate using only local operations of classical communication into bell pairs. And the way that you got there was just by starting out by thinking about how you destroy correlations, thinking about the purification, seeing that there were side effects, which included the production of entanglement, and then, yeah, substituting teleportation. This is like a sort of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, how do you fly? You know, aim at the ground and miss, right? Like, we just kind of got here by accident. And it would have been much harder if we tried to do it on purpose. Okay, so we're running a little bit out of time, unfortunately. Let's see what I can do here. So I'm going to draw another cartoon. I'll call this state merging using classical communication. So what we managed to accomplish here, you know, in our entanglement distillation, I can always throw the reference back in. The reference exists, you know, somewhere out there in the universe. But we use classical communication here. So IAR phi classical communication. And this was bigger than or equal to Rn. Well, we accomplished exactly the same thing as we did in the board on the left, right? So we have 1/2 mutual information, Alice, Bob, phi, bell pairs, and then we have this purified state, N. Right, so if we just take this procedure on the left, substitute in teleportation for the quantum communication, then we get this picture on the right. Sorry, wrong formula, minus the conditional entropy. Now, conditional entropy can be positive or negative, right? If it's a classically correlated state, conditional entropy is positive. Sometimes for entangled states, it's negative. And this was a net cost, right? So I could have put it on the left or I could have put it on the right. So we can also think of it as being on the left. So on the left, I would have just changed the sign and said our entanglement cost is plus conditional entropy bell pairs, right? And so that gives you two different ways of thinking about it. If the conditional entropy is positive, then in order for Alice and Bob to transfer for Alice to transfer her state to Bob, she has to invest entanglement to make it work, Right? So there's a cost. This sort of provides an operational interpretation of conditional entropy. Conditional entropy is supposed to say, how much am I missing about A if I already have B? Right? Well, if that number is positive, the way in which you're missing something about A is that you need to invest entanglement to transfer the state across. Whereas if it's negative, if conditional entropy is negative, it's like saying your uncertainty about A is less than zero when you know B. And in what sense is it less than zero? It means when you try to transfer, you get a side effect, which is useful. Right? So that's what a negative conditional entropy means. And now we know everything we need to know to actually apply this to holography in the 5 minutes remaining. So I want to apply this in the context of the holographic entropy of Balasubramanian et al. So we're going to give an interpretation of holographic entropy. So I can give you the archive reference, but we're running a bit low on time. Balasubramanian et al. And their question, an ADS CFT, you have the boundary, you have your bulk, and if you have some region A, Ryu Takinagi tells us that the entropy of A to leading order is the length of this minimal surface associated with A. I'm just working in 2 plus 1 dimensions right now, over 4 times Newton's constant. Right, so that's the Ryu Takinagi formula. So the Ryu Takinagi formula allows us to relate the lengths of geodesics, or minimal length curves in the bulk, to entropies. And from the first part of my talk, we know how to relate entropies to something operational. It's the effective Hilbert space dimension, the minimal size that you need to compress A to if Alice was holding A and wanted to transfer it to Bob, right? If you wanted to speak in that language. Now, the holographic entropy business asked, well, what if you have a curve which is not minimal, which is not a geodesic, right? Can you write down a formula in terms of boundary quantities that will express, that will describe the length of that curve? And the idea is very beautiful and very simple. So here we have some general curve gamma. You draw tangent curves to gamma like this, all the way over to the end, okay? And if you look at these tangent curves, if we just take this sort of outer envelope up top and add all that up, that provides a good approximation for the length of gamma, right? So we need to try to find a way to express the length of this blue part in terms of boundary quantities. And the observation is to say, well, I need to, the blue part is the red minus these little triangles, right? So you approximate the length of the little triangles, again, by minimal surfaces with the corresponding intervals. Like that. So I sort of have a first interval, a second interval, a third interval up to, say, a kth interval. And what they show in their paper is the length of gamma is equal to the limit as the number of intervals goes to infinity, and we only the step size from one to the next goes to zero, of the sum over intervals of the entropy of those intervals. Right, so this is, or rather, I'll do this in color. Entropy of ik minus these little pieces here, which is the entropy of the kth interval, or j intersect j minus 1. So I apologize, that's a little bit quick. But hopefully the picture motivates this formula, right? That as the separation between these intervals goes to zero, these little purple caps actually provide just the right correction that you need. So this formula, when you take the limit, it's the integral of some derivative of the entropy around the along the boundary. But if you want to give it an operational interpretation, it's useful to sort of think, okay, well, I have interval, say I, the j minus first interval, and then I have the jth interval, and here I have the intersection. So let's call the intersection bj. And let's call the new part aj. Okay? Then I can write my formula as a conditional entropy of aj given bj. Yeah. Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. So this formula for the length of quite a general bulk curve in ADS3 in terms of boundary data is actually an infinite sum of conditional entropies. And until 5 minutes ago, you didn't have an operational interpretation of what conditional entropy was, but now you do. If Alice is holding some system and she wants to transfer that system to Bob, the entanglement cost for doing so is the conditional entropy, right? It's the sort of the uncertainty that Bob had about A if he already has B. And so we could ask the question, operationally. So let's suppose Alice holds a big A, which is the union over all these intervals, and wishes to merge it to Bob. Right? So she wants to merge it to Bob in precisely the sense that we defined here, but we're going to impose conditions on how she can do it. She's not allowed to perform arbitrary transformations on the entire interval in once. We're going to impose locality on scale restrictions on the operations she can perform. You know, we sort of, if you imagine discretizing it, at the jth step, Alice is only allowed to act in this jth interval. Right? So she has a restriction on where she can look at the boundary and sort of at what scale she can look at it. So, we'll say using a streaming protocol, in which at the jth step, she has access only to ij. Right? And what you can prove, you know, let's call it a theorem slightly in quotes, but the minimal EBIT cost is the sum of these conditional entropies, which is the length of the curve. So, this is a general, so this is a sort of direct operational interpretation of what the length of a general curve is. It's the minimal number of bell pairs required for a kind of teleportation protocol that will transfer the boundary state from Alice to Bob, in which that teleportation protocol is required to act locally in the boundary in a way which is defined by the geometry of the bulk curve. And when I say this is a theorem, not only does this protocol exist, but you could say consider all possible protocols that could ever be done, you know, that are subject to this locality restriction, and impose an appropriate, you know, and then you can prove that this is really the minimum. And so it really is an interpretation of the length of the bulk curve. And my last comment would be, in the case of a geodesic, we already have an interpretation, but we could implement this streaming protocol that I just described. And in that case, our intervals look sort of like this. And so the compression procedure starts on the left-hand side and gets and Alice gets access to sort of to A, gets access to information at larger and larger length scales, and sort of starts off by sending the UV information and the more IR information and the further IR information until at some point she has the whole interval and then she's done. So that's just this is just a flavor. Again, there are several applications of this kind of thinking in quantum information in the black hole information problem, in holography. But the take-home message is, one, you can learn interesting things by trying to interpret these functions, the entropy functions, not just by sort of looking at their formal properties. Two, it can be surprisingly, you may not have found it super easy, but it can be surprisingly easy to accomplish things in quantum information that you didn't know how to accomplish before. Well, try to be operational from time to time. You might learn something. before I end, there's a question.
So when you say the minimal entanglement with ghost, what do you mean by minimal when the length is limited?
Right, okay, so you have to impose some cutoff in the boundary theory. So you have to be a bit careful about that. But yes, your point is well taken. There are subtleties in order to really make this make sense. And with that, I think I'm done, and thank you for your attention.
For a couple of questions, if there are any. All right, so if there are no questions, is it? Oh.
Oh, so I think the question was, in this interpretation of the holographic entropy, do you need the state to be a pure state? Oh, just in general. So it is important, the construction that I described, it worked by looking at the purification. And so depending on what question you ask, it is important that the state be pure. But so for example, when we were looking at distillation of EBITs from an arbitrary mixed state, that's a task in which I imagine the reference is held by some environment somewhere, and I don't even care. I don't care about that environment at all. Here I'm really just thinking of phi as a mixed state. The definition of this state transfer task, the real idea is that the reference is out there somewhere. And so if you want to preserve, so you could imagine that the state was not pure, and you wanted to preserve correlations with some other system that that held some correlations with your system, but not the full purification. This procedure would still work, because the hardest thing you can do is preserve all the entanglement. But there might be a procedure to accomplish it that requires that's actually easier, right? Because if you don't have to preserve all of the correlation, but only some of it, then this might be overkill. But the procedure will always work. We accomplish the most demanding version of the task, and then you could think about easier versions potentially. Yeah, Taryn. I'm sorry. How does this work in the single copy setting? So. For example, in the case of this holographic entropy, the archive reference I gave you at the beginning of the paper, one of the things in the paper where I should say, like, the archive reference is the paper in which we worked this out, and the reason we wanted to know about whether we could compress in a CFT in a single copy was because we wanted to make sense of this formula in a single, for a single use. And so, there is a well-developed technology of one-shot information theory, and I don't have time to get into it, but you can take the one-shot version of this formula, like there's a one-shot version of conditional entropy and a one-shot version of this protocol. The one-shot version of conditional entropy isn't just the difference of the entropies, it's something more complicated, but you can prove a bound that involves a difference of entropies, they turn out to be von Neumann entropies, and it all goes through. So the the simple picture that I presented today kind of intuitively captures what you need to do, but the technical details of really proving that it's correct, you have to work harder. Right. So for this to work, there are restrictions on the curve. You do have to be able to. The condition is that you draw these tangent geodesics, and the tangent geodesics are going to eventually head out and intersect the boundary, usually. But you have to be able to interpret the length of those tangent geodesics in terms of entropies. Right. So if they're not minimal. Then they won't be interpreted as entropies. And so there are curves in the bulk for which this breaks down. The other situation in which it breaks down is which, I've assumed that my intervals are always marching left to right, right? But you can imagine a curve that sort of heads into the boundary and wanders around, so that these intervals sort of go from the right and then to the left and to the right again. And we have a more complicated task or for which that seems like the right, for which the length of the curve is the answer, but it's no longer so satisfying because you somehow have to transfer parts of the state to Alice, and then Bob transfers parts that he received back, or Alice transfers to Bob, then Bob transfers to Alice, and they go back and forth like this, and it's a little bit strange. So I have ideas about a much better, like a better motivated story one could tell here, which is actually about compression and connected to Mira, but we don't know how to make that work yet. So for a tripartite system, you have to decide what you mean by mutual information. And that's actually related to the question was, does this interpretation of mutual information in terms of destroying correlations extend to multipartite correlations in some way? And let's see. Yeah, so you have to, first of all, figure out how you're going to try to measure multipartite correlations. One way to try to measure them that works nicely in holography is you look at the function I3, so for three regions, which can be written as the mutual information of BC, or I guess with minus sign, minus the mutual information of A with B, minus the mutual information of A with C. So this function, somehow you're interested in the correlations between A and BC, but ignoring the parts that just come from the bipartite correlations between A and B and A and C. And it turns out that this function is symmetric. It looks asymmetric, but it's symmetric with respect to permutations of A, B, and C. You could apply what we've just done to this function. First, discard qubits from B to eliminate the AB correlations, then discard qubits from C to eliminate the AC correlations. And in holography, you always know that this function is greater than or equal to zero. That's not generally true. That's special to holographic theories. So when you're done, the pairwise mutual informations will be zero, but this larger mutual information will still be non-zero. So that gives you a sort of an operational interpretation. But in general, I don't think that it's fully mapped out.
Again?